This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new Pixar-Disney animated movie Up opens Friday. Earlier this month, Up became the first animated film to open the Cannes Film Festival. My guest is the director and co-writer of Up, Pete Docter. He also directed Monsters, Inc. Up is about an unexpected relationship between an old man and a boy. Carl is a 78-year-old whose beloved wife has died. Carl and his wife dreamed of being adventurers, but they were really homebodies. He made his living selling balloons. Now his neighborhood is getting rebuilt around him, and the developers want him to move to assisted living so they can tear down his house and put up a high-rise. Carl refuses. His way out of the problem is to tie thousands of balloons to his house so he can fly the house to South America, where he once dreamed of making an expedition with his wife. But as he's getting ready, a chubby 8-year-old named Russell knocks on the door. Russell is wearing his wilderness explorer uniform that has a sash covered with badges.
Photo print. SD card.
Good afternoon. My name is Russell, and I am a wilderness explorer in Tribe 54, Sweat Lodge 12. Are you in need of any assistance today, sir?
No.
I could help you cross the street.
No.
I could help you cross your yard.
No.
I could help you cross your porch.
No.
Well, I gotta help you cross something.
No, I'm doing fine.
After Carl slams the door, he cuts loose the hot air balloons and starts piloting his house to South America, not realizing that Russell is still on the porch. So Russell and Carl become companions on this fantastic adventure. Pete Docter, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I love the image that a lot of our listeners might have seen in one of the ads of this old man walking through this exotic jungle landscape, you know, Paradise Falls, mm-hmm. with his house attached to a string that he's carrying as if the house were a balloon, but the house is being held aloft by all these balloons. And it's a beautiful image because it's him trying to take his past with him. And at some point it becomes too heavy. It becomes a burden and he has to figure out if he should let go or not. And I thought, like, I don't know how that image came to you or if you originally meant it to be like a metaphor, but it's such a beautiful image about carrying the past and how it can sometimes become too heavy, too much.
Yeah, it kind of evolved. I mean, as all things do, you know, we started with something about balloons themselves are very poetic and evocative to me, and more than just helium and vinyl or whatever they're made out of, you know, they become this almost metaphor for life in a way. I remember as a kid having a balloon and accidentally letting the string go and watching it just float off and into the sky until it disappeared, and there's something about that even that feels very much like what life is, you know, that you... It's fleeting and it's temporal, and so something about balloons were really appealing, and also the idea of escape and floating away. And so as we developed the whole story, it became a lot about trying to preserve the past. You know, this guy, the whole world has changed. Everything around him is different now. The only thing he has, this feeling of connection with his wife, is his house. So he can't just leave that behind. He has to take it with him.
It reminded me a little of Fitzcarraldo. Did you ever see Fitzcarraldo?
Yeah.
It's a Werner Herzog film,
sure.
In which this explorer who wants to build an opera house in the South American jungle, in order to get to where he's going, he has to carry his steamship over a mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And the burden of that reminded me at some point of the house being dragged,
absolutely,
dragged through
yeah.
the air across.
Absolutely.
Did you see the movie? Did you think about that?
We watched it along the way, yeah, and it was very similar in the sort of preposterous nature of this. You know,
yes, right, and surreal. And,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Sounds like a laugh riot, doesn't it?
Well, it's really funny, and I'll tell you, you had me from the start because very early in the film, the young version of the older man, because it starts earlier in time, like in the 30s and
Right.
The Prohibition era. So he's watching like one of those old newsreel kind of things about this adventurer who goes to Paradise Falls, a forgotten land. And you see like the scientists and the explorers with a protractor.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's so funny, a protractor.
Well, it was high tech back then.
High tech, yeah. So you had me right at the start.
Oh, good.
Did you watch a lot of those newsreels and shorts before making your movie?
Absolutely, yeah. It was a lot of fun to not only try to pick up on the film grain and stuff. You know, we noticed that when they would, say, be in the jungle, they'd have to develop the film themselves, so it would have less contrast and maybe a little washed out. And then versus the film they shot in New York, that would have really striking blacks and whites. And so we tried to mimic all that in the film, as well as even the way we recorded the music, you know, working with Michael Giacchino. We identified, I want heroic, I want drama, suspense, I want this. And so we just did all those, like, library music, and then we did really bad music edits between them. So it's going along, dun, 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 you know, so it'll have these awkward transitions, just like, you know, the real real newsreels.
Just in talking about the old man, one more thing about him, like, the way he sits down in a chair, it's like he slowly lowers himself, and when he gets within plopping distance, he just like lets go and plops into it. And I've seen so many older people have to sit that way. Like, you really got it.
That's great. You noticed that. The other thing we did is he pulls his pants up, like he grabs right above the knee and kind of hikes up his pants. I have no idea why older people do that, but you notice that a lot, you know, just to, I guess, to so that it doesn't get hooked on your heel or something. Anyway, we did look at a lot of folks, our grandparents, and we went to an old folks' home. We kind of came in under the auspices of being a band, because I play the bass and a couple guys who played the ukulele, and so we were playing for these guys and secretly kind of taking little notes for ourselves.
Oh, that's really funny. What do you play? What kind of music?
It was sort of like a Tin Pan Alley type stuff.
Oh, that would be perfect, because it's the kind of music a lot of people, like, in assisted living facilities would have grown up with.
Yeah, they said, oh, you were the greatest band we've had in here for a long time. So it was great. It was a fun fun time.
My guest is Pete Docter, and he directed and co-wrote the new Pixar Disney animated film Up. You created a great creature for the movie, this exotic 13-foot bird named Kevin.
Right.
Well, that's because Russell names it Kevin.
Yeah, exactly.
But I want you to describe the bird that you created.
Well, Kevin is a 13-foot-tall flightless bird, very iridescent plumage, sort of based on a crane that I saw at a zoo. The attraction for me was that these birds, when you see them at the zoo, they almost have no expression. You can't see what they're thinking. They give you no kind of advance warning of are they happy or sad, or at least to me. I'm sure bird experts can tell. But they're really unpredictable and quirky and funny. And I just, the animator in me was like, I want to animate that. So that's kind of where Kevin came from, was just the joy of seeing these quirky behaviors.
So, but you gave Kevin emotion, the kind of emotion you couldn't read in the real bird,
right,
that you based him on. So what kind of methods did you find for giving your bird emotion?
Well, the cool thing was we did the same thing that I described, where there is no facial expressions. And the Muppets do this wonderfully, where, you know, you have like Fozzie, who has no facial, other than he can open and close his mouth. The rest of it's just movement. And so the bird has a great deal of expression and a range of attitudes, but it's all through movement. It's almost like Charlie Chaplin or Buster Keaton, which, of course, all animators study, and those are our roots. So, you know, just through the movement, the posing, the speed at which they move, we were able to get all this attitude.
So did you go to South America?
We did. Yeah, there was a group of 10 of us. And this is the great thing about working at Pixar. You know, Toy Story, we got to go to the toy store with the company credit card. And on this one, since we set it in South America, a group of 10 of us flew down to South America to these amazing tabletop mountains. And we hiked up there. It took us 3 days just to get there by plane, helicopter, jeep. And then we hiked up. We slept up there. We drew a lot. We took tons of pictures, of course. And there are fantastic, weird plants found nowhere else in the world, these weird rock shapes that are just windswept, strange, bizarre shapes. Some of them look like people or animals. And a lot of ideas from the film came from that trip.
So what's in your sketchbook that you took back from there?
Well, there's a lot of pictures of myself, I'm usually drawn to drawing people. Like, I love to go to the airports and just put on, like, dark glasses so nobody can tell I'm staring at them and just draw people. It's a lot of fun, and it's just endless hours of entertainment just watching the way people do simple things, even, like, eat a meal or, you know, wipe their kid's face or whatever, just great behavior stuff. But up there, of course, and even there, I ended up drawing a lot of my coworkers. But the reason we were there was to draw the landscape, and I struggled as best I could to capture that.
And we talked a little bit about the bird that you created for Up. There's a bunch of dogs. There's a pack of really, like, mean dogs, and then there's a really pleasant, companionable dog named Doug.
Right.
First of all, I think it's kind of interesting that, you know, they go to this, like, exotic place. And usually in adventure films, especially in the old ones, mm-hmm. Before people were very kind of politically aware of what they were doing, this, you know, adventurers would go to an exotic land in Africa, and then the natives would want to cook them in a big pot. And it was just, like, the most kind of insulting image of indigenous people that you could ask for. And you made it possible to not deal with that at all by having the villains, with the exception of one person, be dogs.
Right.
So you didn't – and there's a good guy dog, too. So you didn't have to worry about, you know, offending anybody.
Yeah, and of course, that is one of the staples of adventure film. So I won't pretend we didn't at least discuss that. You know, we had some ideas about that. But, yeah, it just seemed, again – keeping on the sort of isolation thing. And there is something for those of us who have dogs as pets. I mean, I'm sure most people have the same experience as I do, is we make up dialogue for the dog. So the dog is sitting next to the dinner table, and we make up things that she's talking about, which most of the time is, are you going to eat that? Because I could help you with that. If you need help, I am happy to. So that's kind of where the talking dogs came from. And Bob Peterson, who did most of the dialogue and actually did the voice of Doug, just has this great mind for thinking like a dog.
And explain how it is that Doug can speak, the dog.
Yeah, the invention we came up with was this collar, which allows the dog's thoughts to be translated. So the dog in behavior is acting just like a normal dog, panting or doing whatever, but you're hearing the dialogue from the dog's brain. So that allowed us to focus on things that a real dog would focus on, which is, you know, food and sniffing at squirrel, you know, things like that. So
And the collar has adjustments so you could change the language.
Absolutely. Very important.
Let's hear a clip of Doug, the dog, and listen to his voice. And the two main characters are in this, too. And Bob Peterson, one of the writers, is doing the voice of Doug.
We have your dog.
Whoa.
Wonder who he belongs to.
Sit, boy. Hey, look, he's trained. Shake. Uh-huh. Speak.
Hi there.
Did that dog just say hi there?
Oh, yes.
Bruh!
My name is Doug. I have just met you, and I love you. My master made me this collar. He is a good and smart master, and he made me this collar so that I may talk. Squirrel! My master is good and smart.
It's not possible.
Oh, it is, because my master is smart.
Cool. What do these do, boy?
Hey, would you go to acuerdo contigo? I use that collar. Watashiwa hanashima. To talk with, I would be happy if you stop.
So that's a clip from the new Pixar Disney animated movie Up, and my guest, Pete Docter, co-wrote and directed the film. Pete, what are some of your favorite talking animated animals?
Huh. Well, I mean, of course, the Bugs Bunny, and there's a dog named Charlie Dog that I always think of. It was a Chuck Jones character. Let's see. Other favorite characters. Well, I mean, I tend to drift over to the Warner Brothers characters as my favorite just characters, because they're so rich and funny. As movies, I tend to drift over to the Disney films, you know, as stories and things. Dumbo is one of my favorites. It's just such a simplicity, a wonderful simplicity to it. And as a kid, you know, I saw certain things about it, all the fun and, you know, pink elephants on parade and flying with the crows and things. And now looking back on it, it's got this added dimension to it as a parent that, you know, when you have baby mind, the scene with the trunks, and they can't even see each other. They can just kind of hold trunks. I've yet to watch that without crying, you know. And Cinderella is great, too. It's got a great sense of pacing. I hadn't seen it for a while. and watched it again a couple of years ago, and it's just got this great rhythm where you allow for moments. We tried to do this in this film as well. In a way, this film was trying to harken back to some of those films where you set up a situation, and instead of having to go, what happens next, move it along, you can allow the characters to just behave and react. And to me, some of the greatest animation, Miyazaki does this, Hayao Miyazaki in his films, these just little observations. And that's all they are. They don't further the plot, but they are beautiful little glimpses into real life, somehow captured and distilled and made even more real through animation. And that's what we're trying to do in this film as well.
Now, I read that for the voice of Russell, the boy in the movie, that you cast the brother of a kid who actually came to audition.
Yeah.
The kid that you cast didn't come to audition. He was the brother of the kid who came to audition. How did that happen?
Well, yeah, and hopefully that hasn't caused a rift between them.
That's what I keep wondering. Like, what's it like to be the actual acting brother and not get the part?
I know. Well, yeah. His brother, Jordan's brother, Hunter, still does quite a bit of acting on his own. So I think he
survived.
Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, we were looking for somebody. I this is always a treacherous area to walk into as you're approaching something like a kid, because it's so easy to be cloying and sappy and or just like bad acting, you know. And we wanted this to be authentic and real sounding. And when we heard this kid, he came in and, like you say, he wasn't even planning to audition. His brother stepped up and they said, thank you, great. Well, how about you? Jordan, why don't you come over here? And he just, I think he talked about judo or something, you know. And his voice just made me laugh. He had this really wonderful, sweet, innocent voice. And it's a little bit like you hear the stories of the voice of Thumper from Bambi. You know, they were reading kids, and the director said, oh, get him out of here. He can't act. And the animator said, no, keep him, you know, because there's something really charming and quirky and kind of undefinably odd. And that's exactly what we got with Jordan. He just has this really great appeal to his stuff. And then, of course, we did have to work a little bit to get some of the acting. He covers a big range of emotions. And having never done it before, you know, we basically did a lot of tricks where, like, you know, we tried to get him to laugh and it was just not really working. So I picked him up by the ankle, held him upside down, and tickled him as he said the line. So as he's being tickled by the bird, that's what that is. So, yeah, it's a tricky gig, especially here. You know, you're in a room that has, and we record the dialogue first, of course, so there's no animation to react to. You're just in a gray room with a bunch of words on a page, and 9 times out of 10, no other actors even. We try to read opposite. Bob Peterson and myself would usually read opposite, but it largely has to kind of come to life in their own heads, the actors.
So you cast Ed Asner as the older man. So did you have an idea of what he would look like before you cast Ed Asner, or which came first in your mind?
Well, we had the story, and we even designed the character. He was finished. We had him all. I don't think he was quite finished being built in the computer, but the design was there. And what we did, and we have done this on all the films, is we grab little snippets of dialogue from other movies. And so while we're looking at these designs, we just listen. And some people just fit perfectly, and Ed was one of those guys.
Oh, I see. You take their dialogue from other films and juxtapose it with the image that you have and see if it fits.
Exactly.
So what did you do with him, like Mary Tyler Moore show stuff?
Yeah, and then we got some of his more recent films, you know, because some time has passed since Mary Tyler Moore.
A lot.
But yeah, he just had this real sort of still the gruffness and the, you know, angularity to his voice with an underlying sense that, oh, this guy really does care, you know. Which is exactly what we needed for the film.
Now, your daughter does the voice of the young girl who becomes Ed Asner's wife in the movie, who becomes the man's wife in the movie. How did your daughter... what a shock that you would find your daughter, but why did you give her the part?
Well, the way we work at Pixar is we write the script, but then we quickly move on into story reel, which is basically like a comic book version of the film. And then we do our own dialogue and music and sound effects, all in an effort to be able to basically sit in the theater and watch the movie before we shoot it, essentially. And that way, you know, once you get into animation, it's horribly time-consuming. It's like animators do about 4 seconds a week, you know. And that's not even including all the shaders and the lighting and the modeling and all that. So we want to whittle out all the stuff that we have any questions about first. And so what we did when we got to that part, yeah, the beginning of the film takes place with in the 30s as their kids. And we knew that if one of us tried to do the voice of a kid, people would be so distracted by that that you wouldn't pay attention to the scene. So we just got my daughter to come in, and we thought, well, this will work until we find a professional actor. But enough people really loved it. In fact, that was the first thing Ed Asner said when we showed him. He said, "Who does the voice of that kid? She steals the show." So that was pretty cool.
So did you have her redo it or just use the tracks that she did?
No, we just used the tracks. Yeah, she was about 7 and a half at the time. And we worked with her much like we worked with Jordan, or, you know, kind of tricking her into things or doing the copy game where we'd say the line and she'd parrot it back. And we found with both kids that, you know, physicality is a big thing. And so standing stiffly in front of a microphone is not really the best way to get a great performance. With Jordan, a lot of times I would say, okay, now you've memorized the line. Before you say this next take, run back around that chair, run around 3 times, jump up and down, run back to the microphone, and then say the line, ready, go. And so you just get them all worked. How many times do I need? Oh, okay. And then he'd be much more animated and lively having run around the room. So that was fun.
Yeah, that's
it was pretty exhausting
cool.
for me, too, by the end of the day.
Now, Up is in 3D. And I'll confess, I had known that, but when I went to the advanced screening of it before interviewing you, I'd kind of forgotten that it was in 3D, and I didn't see it in 3D.
Mm-hmm.
So what did I miss? I really love the film. It obviously doesn't have to be in 3D to
right.
enjoy it, but what did I miss?
Well, I mean, we tried to use 3D as just another element to tell the story. So, for example, when Carl is alone in his house, we really tried to squash space to make him feel claustrophobic and locked in. And then by contrast, as he floats his house off, we really tried to push the depth and make him seem free. So it's, to us, kind of another tool like lighting, like color, cinematography. It's just another way of furthering the emotion that we're trying to communicate to the audience.
So did you work on the 3D part of it?
I worked with – there was a separate group that we set up. So initially, when we started the project, we had no thought of doing 3D. We were just doing – focused on story and characters. And John Lasseter came to us, I think it was about a year and a half, 2 years in, and said, hey, we'd really love to do this in 3D. So we set up a group, much like, you know, we have the art department, we have the animation department, and now we have the 3D department. And they followed along sequence by sequence and would use 3D in the way I described, really trying to further the story. But I'll confess, it was not really in the forefront of my mind. The things I was most focused on were just story and character. We tried to use it a little more like a window that you look into, as opposed to, I don't know about you, whenever I see 3D movies and stuff is going booga 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 out in your face, I'm suddenly aware, I'm sitting in the theater wearing dopey glasses, you know. So we tried to use it much more subtly and a little more like, you know, my father had a bunch of stereophonic test records when I was growing up, and you'd have, you know, bongos on the left channel and trombones on the right channel. And now it's much more integrated and subtle. And that's kind of the way we were trying to approach the 3D on this film as well.
The movie is dedicated in part to one of the Disney animators from the early days. Tell us about him.
Yeah, Joe Grant was a guy, and this was really the great pleasure of having worked on Toy Story and having that be as successful as it was. Suddenly, I got to meet all these old heroes of mine that had made all the Disney films, you know, Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnson. And Joe Grant was basically second only to Walt in development, the story development team back in the 40s, 30s and 40s. He was head of story on Dumbo and designed the Wicked Queen in Snow White. So really, you know, amazing artist. And he was still working in his 90s. That's when I got to know him. And he was just one of these guys who was always looking for new ways of expressing himself, new techniques, new pencils or pens. And one thing he talked about a lot in when I would pitch him things was, what are you giving the audience to take home? And at first I was like, well, what does that mean, taking the audience to take home? What he was talking about was, what are you putting up on the screen that's emotionally relatable, that they will identify with and think about, not only when the movie's done, but the next day or the next week or the next year? And, you know, that's what we always try to do in our films, is definitely there in those great Disney films.
When you started as an animator, were you given, like, the bottom of the pyramid kind of jobs to do? And what are those jobs like?
Well, yeah, when I started, this is back in the 80s, I was painting the backs of cells. Of course, cells are these celluloid sheets of plastic. They're actually made out of acetate, but they don't use them at all anymore. It's all computers. So the animator would draw something on paper. It would then be inked or Xeroxed onto the cell, and then my job was to paint the backs the right color, you know, so that they would read against the background and not just you couldn't see through them. So that's kind of like the bottom tier. And then I worked my way up doing in-betweens, and this was all...
What's an in-between?
In-between, so an animator does the key poses. He'll do extremes, you know, like a character reaching out for a glass of water and then another one of him drinking. And the in-betweener has to do all the drawings that go between those two. You know, it could be 12, 20, what, 3, whatever, in-betweens. And then that was all hand-drawn, and that's kind of what I was picturing that I would end up doing. And then I got a call towards my last year of school from John Lasseter. And it, working at Pixar was great because they paired these amazing people who knew brilliant scientists with artists, each one ignorant in the other's work and yet both working towards the same common goal and produce some pretty groundbreaking stuff.
Earlier in the film, you have to establish, since the movie is in part about an older person's relationship to his past. You have to establish what his past was mm-hmm. before getting into the heart of the story.
Right.
And you, in just like a few minutes, establish this like beautiful relationship with his wife. You know, they meet as children. They both share this love of adventure. And it's a really kind of sweet but also sad relationship. And when she dies, you're just so sad. And it's so much to squeeze into, what, 3 or 4 minutes. Can you describe a little what went into reducing a whole backstory and a marriage and a life into this little sequence?
Yeah, that was probably the sequence I'm most proud of, that scene. It's just... And we started much like you would writing, say, a term paper where you go way long. You just put in all this. We had a bunch of scenes that were little with dialogue and just little short little bursts of life. And then we assembled all that together and we realized, oh, this is way too long. And so Bob Peterson had written this great first draft of it. Ronnie Del Carmen, who's our head of story, started drawing it. And he has this beautiful way of just kind of kissing the paper with his pencil, and they wonderfully expressive and very sort of poetic, lyrical drawings. And we got to that point, and we kept cutting and cutting, and we took out dialogue, we took out sound effects even. And it was sort of inspired a little bit by my parents growing up took a lot of Super 8 films of us as kids. And looking at them now, they're just these almost more emotional experiences to watch because the sound isn't there. You know, all you have is the flicker of the projector. And I think you as an audience member are sort of drawn into that and participate a little bit more.
Tell me more about the impact of those Super 8 movies that your parents made of the family when you were young.
Yeah, I mean, they're just films of us standing in a hole my dad dug to plant a tree, or my mom walking around pregnant with my sister. And, you know, these are like I have probably fleeting glimpses in my own life, memories of that. But watching them on screen, they're kind of... I don't know. And there might be something about the fact that they're projected as well, that they're just kind of shadows of a past that and as you watch it, it's like I say, I think because there's no sound, you're missing something. It becomes slightly more abstract and yet almost more real. In the same way, we have tapes, audio tapes of my sisters and I talking as well, and that's almost more emotional than videotape. When you get them both together somehow, it's almost... You can sit back and watch it like TV. It's kind of everything's fed to you, whereas by taking one of those elements away, you have to be more actively participating in the experience.
Pete Docter, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Pete Docter directed and co-wrote the new Pixar-Disney animated movie Up. It opens Friday. Earlier this month, Up became the first animated film to have the prestigious position of opening the Cannes Film Festival.